Welcome. I'm Eric Fleming, host of A Moment with Eric Fleming, the podcast of our time. I want to personally thank you for listening to the podcast. If you like what you're hearing, then I need you to do a few things. First, I need subscribers. I'm on Patreon at patreon.com/A Moment with Eric Fleming. Your subscription allows an independent podcaster like me the freedom to speak truth to power and to expand and improve the show. Second, leave a 5-star review for the podcast on the streaming service you listen to it. That will help the podcast tremendously. Third, go to the website, momenteric.com. There you can subscribe to the podcast, leave reviews and comments, listen to past episodes, and even learn a little bit about your host. Lastly, don't keep this a secret like it's your own personal guilty pleasure. Tell someone else about the podcast. Encourage others to listen to the podcast and share the podcast on your social media platforms, because it is time to make this moment a movement. Thanks in advance for supporting the podcast of our time. I hope you enjoy this episode as well. Hello, and welcome to another Moment with Eric Fleming. I am your host, Eric Fleming. And today, I got a guest again, y'all. I got another guest. I get so excited when I'm able to interview people. And so, I want to get into this first interview because this is a brother that I had not met prior to the interview, but just wanting to talk to somebody that's really invested in Black podcasting. I think Black podcasting is one of the tools, from a political standpoint, that we can use to get the message out to address issues in our community and you know, really flesh them out a lot better than depending on mainstream media or, you know, 2-minute TikTok videos to really get it out there. And that's, again, the motivation why I do what I do. And so to have somebody to come on who has totally invested in this medium, who is totally invested in fulfilling that part of mission, as well as dealing with other subjects and dealing with other conversations that we have in the Black community, I think is really, really important. And then he's a Black entrepreneur. So, you know, if you know me, you know that politics is supposed to be the gateway toward Black wealth. That has always been my mindset. And, you know, some people wondered why I would introduce certain legislation and all that kind of stuff. But that was kind of the target, like making it mandatory, for example, to teach kids entrepreneurship and financial literacy. I wanted that to be in the curriculum of every school in the state, every high school in the state of Mississippi, because the majority of our kids were going to these high schools. And I wanted them, at least, even if they don't start their own business, right, that they have the tools to be out there so they don't make the mistakes that I made or others in my generation made, as far as like dealing with credit and, you know, getting loans and, you know, all the nuances about starting a business and all that. I wanted them to have a heads up. And again, that's the mission of Black politicians, not for individual wealth for the politician, but to create an atmosphere so that the community can gain wealth, right? Because when we still hear talking about for every $100 a white person has in assets, Black people only have like 5. Somebody said 10 on another show I was listening to. I said, well, that's some progress, because last I'd heard it was 5, right? But 5, 10, that's still well below 100. And so I feel that every elected official, whether you're a council person, a mayor, in the state legislature, you know, if you get to be governor, if you get to be president, the objective should be increasing Black wealth, because in the United States of America, wealth is power. And just look around and just see the groups of people that are getting their political wishes granted. Just tie that into the power of their wealth, right? And, you know, that's why we're kind of an anomaly, because we've been able to make political gains and we spend a lot. But as far as individual and community wealth as a group, as a power, we're not there yet. So that's, you know, motivation of trying to get people who are in business on a political show, because to me, there's a direct tie-in. So enough about that. Let me talk about my first guest. This brother's name is Chris Colbert. Chris Colbert is a Webby and New York Festival Award-winning podcast host / producer / writer, as well as the CEO and founder of DCP Entertainment, a media agency for underrepresented voices, and the co-founder of Podstream Studios Times Square, a recording space for content creators like podcasters, YouTubers, and live streamers. Having previously worked at SXM and Cadence 13, and with names like Jamie Foxx, Teray, Joyanne Reed, Zach Levitt, iHeartMedia, Wondery, Essence, People, Crooked Media, Sports Illustrated, and the United Negro College Fund, Chris and his team specialize in media partnerships and content development for audio and video projects. Ladies and gentlemen, it is my distinct honor and privilege to have as a guest on this podcast, Chris Colbert. All right. I am honored to have a CEO in the house, Chris Colbert. How you doing, brother? You doing good?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for accepting the invitation, man. You are a veteran in this podcasting business, and I wanted to pick your brain about podcasting, especially in the Black community. But what I normally do, if I can, is try to find a quote that's either deals with the work or, you know, something that you may have said or something, and want you to expound on it. But I'm going to do something a little different with you. Yeah. There is a sister, Septima Clark, and she said, "The greatest evil in our country today is ignorance. We need to be taught to study rather than to believe." How does that quote sit with you, and especially in what you do?
It's interesting, because I feel like my interpretation might be a lot different than others. You know, the way I hear that, and I'll give a little preface here. I do a podcast called Say Their Name. You know, I, along with Adele Coleman, my chief operating officer, my co-writer, co-producer, co-host on the series, we go around the country interviewing families impacted by police violence. And one of the things that we are very intentional about doing is hearing directly from the families about what their perspective is, and like what their true story is, and how can we help? And this is how it relates back to that quote. I think a lot of times, out of ignorance, and even though it might be ignorance where we're trying to help, we come in and we helicopter in and try to solve things for people without listening to what they really need. And I think that's what we really try to do with our companies. That's how we try to, you know, work with intention for Say Their Name, where it's, you tell us what you need. We're not going to come in and tell you what you need. And so that's the way I approach life in general, you know, not only just with these companies.
So what was your motivation to start DCP Entertainment?
So I worked in satellite radio for 11 years. I worked at Sirius XM back when it was Sirius, before the merger and through all that. There for 11 years, started as an intern, worked my way all the way up to a director of urban talk and comedy. And I'd say my original career goal was to become a program director. And I got that by the age of like 24, 26. And I say that because like at 24, I was doing the responsibilities, and then 26, I actually got the title. And so once I hit that career goal, I was like, okay, well, next, what's the next goal? And the next goal ended up being more mission driven than it was about my own personal title or things like that. It was, I want to create more opportunities for people of color, you know, here at this company. But also, as I looked at the situation there, I looked across the media landscape and saw that there weren't enough opportunities for people of color, not only on the microphone, but behind the scenes. And even if you were getting those opportunities, let's say a host or something like that, those shows wouldn't get the same level of talent booking and marketing and press. And so as I climbed that corporate ladder and got higher and higher up, you know, to these decision-making roles, I realized I still didn't have the power I needed to make that kind of change. I still was just kind of a figurehead in a lot of ways. And also realizing that even if I'm making changes here, that's not helping the greater ecosystem. And so that's when I created DCP Entertainment in the background while I was still at Sirius, as this platform that was going to help BIPOC individuals on, you know, on screen, on the microphone and behind the scenes. But then I also realized these were also issues for LGBTQ plus community members, people with disabilities. And so I really expanded that underrepresented communities umbrella that we now serve with DCP. And then as I was really mapping out my exit, I got hired away to a podcasting company called Cadence 13 as the head of their audio documentary division. And that's when I really saw the creativity and the ability in podcasting to really create great content and connect with audiences. And also a medium that is still so young that I can actually influence that change a lot easier before we get to a point of say like Oscar is so white or things like that. And so that's where the focus really became on podcasting, even though we're just an overall media company.
So what is the appeal of Black podcasting?
I think the appeal, and this is, I think, for all podcasting, but specific to Black podcasting, is that connectivity. I think it's, you know, what makes podcasting special is most people listen and feel like they're a fly on the wall to a conversation that maybe they would never be privy to. Or they feel like they're hearing from, you know, a family member or a friend because the viewpoints and experiences really touch them personally. And so especially for Black people, a lot of times when it comes to media, we don't have those opportunities. Everything is kind of sanitized before it gets to us when it's, you know, coming out of a major company. And so podcasting allows you to cut through that. There's no real gatekeepers. Yes, there are gatekeepers when we're talking about trying to make it up to the tops of the elites in podcasting. But, you know, there's no gatekeepers to be able to create and release a podcast and reach an audience. So I think that's that special space, especially for us as Black people.
Yeah, I tend to agree with that, because the way that I started my podcast was basically a rant, right? It was like every day Donald Trump was like saying something stupid. And as somebody that had been in the political game, it just was like, you know, I was feeling frustrated. And so as I started doing this, you know, and then my friends and all that stuff was like, hey man, you know, are you going to do a show, or is just you just broadcasting your viewpoints? And I just said, well, it just kind of started off as therapy. And you know, I just kind of put it together like a little show thing or whatever, but you know, not really taking it serious. And then as more of my friends started saying, you ought to just, you know, structure it a little bit and see where it goes. And that's basically how I got started. So that whole piece about that's your friend talking, that's somebody you can relate to talking about something that's on your mind. I think that is a powerful connection. So
if I may say, you mentioned this thing, you mentioned the therapy part. I completely agree with that. I do I just ended the season, but I do a show called Entrepreneur Struggle, where I talk to other founders about the challenges creating and scaling up your company. And that was a similar situation. It started kind of as a rant on Instagram, and not really a rant, but just me just talking about my experiences and how I'm trying to overcome things. And hey, please comment and let me know how you did so I can learn. And then it became, you know, let me actually sit down with people and learn how they overcame things so I can maybe get better. And yeah, it, it started as a therapy for me, but then it became a therapy for my guests and also the audience who was like, oh my God, they're going through the same thing. And maybe they're at this level of success. And now I know that we're struggling with the same thing. So I can achieve just what they did, you know? So I think that that connectivity of not feeling alone is also that really big piece of it.
Well, let me ask this question. It says a recent study, and I say recent because it was like in 2020, by XM Media, Mindshare, and Edison Research found that 36% of Black Americans, which is about 12 million US adults, tune in every month. This is a relatively new audience, as 42% have only been listening for less than a year. Do you see that market growing as far as African Americans tuning into podcasts?
Absolutely. And I think, and I know a lot of people feel a certain way about video podcasts, and we're actually recording on video at the moment. I think especially with video podcasts, it's making it even easier to reach our Black audiences, particularly because of YouTube. YouTube, and I forget the exact stats, but the main users of YouTube are Black. A lot of it's music listening, but that also is going to help us with the SEO, the search engine. YouTube is the second biggest search engine in the world. And so with podcasting coming into the YouTube space, it allows us to reach our audiences where they already are. And it still bleeds the lines of what's a YouTube show versus a podcast. But it doesn't really matter to me. I don't care how we define a podcast. As long as we're reaching the audiences and getting out the messaging that we need to, I don't care what you call it and what medium we're on. So yeah, I think YouTube is really helping us connect with more Black people. And I think that's why that stat that you mentioned in terms of those new audiences, that coincides with YouTube entering the podcast game.
And I still haven't ventured out to do a video version of this. I always say I have a face for radio, so it's
These
like,
are lies, everybody. These are definitely lies. You've got
but I'm just
like
saying.
well kept goatee over here. I'm like, man, I'm gonna go see game over.
But I like the power of the voice. I'm just, I'm old school. It's like everybody likes UFC fighting. I like boxing, right? It's just something about that purity. And I think when you talk about when we're talking about that connectivity, when you eavesdropping in on a conversation, you ain't got to see who's in the room, but you can hear them. You know what I'm saying? And
Yeah, that piece of the mind is strong.
feel that vibe. So that's kind of where I am with it. But I'm gonna get with the trend, I guess. I'm gonna put this ugly mug on the TV or something. But
Or at least, stuff for social media clips, get that pretty face out there.
Well, my classmates did say I look pretty good for my age at our last reunion. So
See, you're already getting indicators. Listen to them.
just a little bit. Seriously, how powerful of an impact do you think Black podcasting has made in the political discussions?
Again, I think that's another really important place. We, have our show Democracy-ish with Danielle Moody and Wajahat Ali. And I love that, there's not many shows out there like that. We have, a Black and brown person speaking on politics. And it's not just about like, hey, we're Black and we're brown. It's no, we have a certain perspective. We have a certain experiences in the world that color how we look at politics. And both of them are also children of immigrants. And I think that's really unique. And those are takes that you don't get on MSNBC and CNN and other, news outlets. So I think it's really important that we have podcasting as an outlet because, again, there's no gatekeeper saying like, oh, you can't say that. You can't speak from your heart. Oh, you went too hard on somebody. Well, sometimes these people need the, on both sides of the aisle, they need someone to be talking critically so we can, open up our minds to what is actually happening. And also, obviously, it takes a lot of responsibility to be those speakers. So I'm not just saying anybody should be out there talking on politics and being the authority there, but we all have experiences and perspectives, and I think we should all have the opportunity to be able to have a platform.
Yeah, I hope that we are making a difference. That's the main reason why I do what I do. And I definitely believe that's why you and the crew over there at DCP has been doing what they need to do, especially with the politically geared shows. Because I think, I just said that there really wasn't anybody out there watching TV, all the talking heads and all that. And I respect all those people because they're good at what they do, right? but I know that there are limitations because of ownership. And so when you have an independent situation like me or a black owned situation like what you have, it gives us a little more freedom and it gives us a lot more latitude to say what's really on our mind and really what needs to be said. And I just feel, you know, no matter how I'm feeling or whatever, I try to make a commitment at least once a week to make sure that even if I don't have any guests, to get something out there to try to edify and enhance the conversation.
Important.
Yeah. And I think it's having an impact on getting people to participate in the process too.
Absolutely. Because also to the exact point you just made, I'll use Danielle Moody again as the example. Yes, she's on MSNBC, but when you get to hear her on Democracy-ish or other show Woke AF, you get to hear her talking like us. You know, you get to hear her cursing and being upset and you know, sometimes getting emotional and crying because of just how painful this is. And that's how people relate. Like, oh, they're not just, you know, saying this to get, you know, to be able to stay on MSNBC or get paid. No, they truly care about this country, or they truly care about what they're talking about. And I think that resonates so much more when you get to talk freely like that.
Yeah. Let's get more in the weeds as far as the podcasting community. What are the value of organizations like Black Podcasters Association or the Black Podcasting Awards? How has that helped your business and your artists, for a lack of a better term, your talent, as far as doing what needs to be done and coming up with a product that you can be proud of and you can, make a contribution with?
Yeah, you know, what Corey's done with Black Podcast Association and his whole team over there, I think is absolutely incredible. Building a community that supports each other, you know, much like we were talking about, just of like listening to a podcast and feeling community, he actually creates a community that, you know, talks to each other and they teach each other, like, okay, if you're getting a contract for the first time, now you have someone to reach out to say, hey, does this make sense? Can you take a look at this? You know, as you're doing your show, getting feedback on what's going on, also having a network of people to possibly be guests on your show. But also, you know, Corey does a great job too with Black Podcasters Association to do Black Pod News, where he's keeping you up to date on what's happening in the industry. So I think just that total resource is incredible. And also in that newsletter, amplifying podcasts. So, you know, helping people find shows that they might love. I think, you know, a lot of these listening platforms like Apple and Spotify, and I love all of them. A lot of times, you know, they're not giving a lot of love to the independent creators, and particularly the Black independent creators. And so this is the way to be able to help, you know, people be able to get discovered. You know, when it comes to Black Pod Awards, same kind of situation. You know, what Demetrius is doing there and that team, and Adele on our team actually helps him along with some others. It's really important to have a platform where, again, these other mainstream award shows a lot of times don't necessarily get us nominations. And even if we do get nominated, the judges are really just voting on those top companies. And just the entry fees themselves, I don't think people realize how much it costs to enter a lot of these award shows. They cost $200 or more just to enter one podcast into one category. Who's got that kind of money, especially if you're doing multiple, you know, shows, or if you're, you know, trying to apply for multiple categories, whereas the Black Pod Awards is a much lower cost. You know, I forget exactly what it is now, but when we first started doing it, it was only like $20, $10, $20. So it makes the barrier to entry so much easier for us to be able to get an award. And the awards aren't just to pat ourselves on the back. These awards can help you land deals in the future. It gives you a level of credibility when you're trying to get a guest on your show, or again, you're trying to get some kind of monetization for your podcast. So that's really important. And you know, I also am on the board of advisors for the BIPOC podcast creators. So very similar to what, you know, Black Podcast Association does in terms of helping, you know, people. And then I also am on the board of the Podcasting Seriously Awards Fund. So I just want to mention that in terms of, like, we actually reimburse people for being able to submit to awards, even like up to $200. So, you know, there are other resources out there. But to your point, I think Black Podcast Association and Black Podcasting Awards have done an incredible job to really give us a footing in the industry and giving us a level of credibility.
Yeah, I highlighted them because I'm biased. I really like them. I really like the people in those organizations. I like the way that they utilize the responsibility that they have. They take it very seriously, for one.
Oh, yeah.
And then two, it's like it's the only award show that you know, that I know, I should say, that it's like will give you feedback and say, hey, look, yes. you know, you didn't win. This was your score. This was what people were looking at, blah, blah. The reason why I have guests on my show is because of that first year that I got nominated. And they said, you know, you would, I forget the young lady's name now, but she was like saying, you might want to interview a couple of people just, you know, instead of just you talking all the time and just bring in some different perspectives. And, you know, I figured out a way to get some guests on and here we are. Right. But I think that support mechanism, because, you know, that's the one thing I compare. Like when people say, well, you had a chance to go to a PWI. Why did you choose an HBCU? Right. And it's like, it's that support. It's a different vibe at a historically black college than it is at an Ivy League or close to Ivy League school. You know what I'm saying? It's a whole different feel, because it's more than just your professor. It's your advisor. It's your role model. It's your mentor. It's somebody that has experienced what you are about to experience. And if you can find somebody like that at a PWI, great, but most of the time you're not. And so, and it's going to be a lot more expensive for you to get that lesson too. Right. And you touched on that as far as with the Black Podcasting Awards, it's only like, if you get in early, it's like $20. I think the most I think anybody pays is like maybe $40, $50 if they do it at the last minute, but that's still, like you said, way cheaper than all these other award things. And, you know, these people bug you just like their telemarketers. Like, well, you haven't submitted your podcast. I said, yeah, I ain't got $200. You going to give me a scholarship so I can apply for an award? I mean, 100%. You know, yeah. So that's the reason I wanted to, because I wanted people to hear somebody that is cultivating multiple podcasts for our community to kind of talk about how there are support organizations out here specifically for us. And I'm not, you know, not to discredit any other organizations that you mentioned, but those two are kind of near and dear to my heart because I know their intentions and know what they're trying to do. So I just wanted to have a CEO of a podcasting company say something nice about them.
Well, and to your point, like both of them, Demetrius and Corey, with those organizations, like they're constantly asking, what can we be doing better too? Like, they're not just, you know, it's not just the them deciding what to do. Like, you know, I'll use Demetrius as the example. I remember being at a podcast movement a year ago, and he's literally going up to every Black person, hey, Black Podcasting Awards, what can we do better to market ourselves? Or what can we do better to support the podcasters? Okay, do you want to join our team to actually implement things? Or, you know, can I talk to you a little bit further later? Like, they truly, truly care, to your point.
And the coolest thing after every award show is the after party. I just love that. You know, people actually are drinking. We're drinking on Zoom. You know what I'm saying? But it was a good chat.
Well, and I don't even know if I'm allowed to announce it, but I'm going to do it anyway. Sorry, Demetrius. Black Podcasting Awards is going to be hosted at my studio in Times Square this year, the Podstream studio. So, yeah, I'm really excited to be part of that after party this year.
Yeah, because they've been wanting to do a live show at a location where as many people that have been nominated can physically be there. So, yeah, I think that's going to be good. That's why I'm hoping. I've got my fingers crossed. Anyway. But I'm up against your shows for competition, so, you know, I got my fingers crossed. But seriously though, I appreciate you saying that. And since we're talking about, you know, feedback and all that stuff, define in your mind the criteria for a successful podcast. If somebody's interested in doing this, what are some tips or some guidelines you can give somebody?
I guess I'll flip that question a little bit to say you need to define what success means to you first. So, you know, success can mean monetization, and I'll get back to that in a second. It can mean monetization. It can mean impact. It can mean it's a lead generator back to another business. I think there's many different ways to define success. And I think you first have to figure that out to then figure out what your roadmap is to get there. when it comes to monetization, if you're really just trying to do this to make money, you know, I'll say just, but if your main priority is to do this to make money through ads, it's going to be a long haul. Like, it's going to take you years to probably get there, because there just are so many podcasts out there, and there are certain barriers for us as people of color. But, you know, if that is your goal, then you have to set expectations at that point. That way you don't get what we call pod fade, where, you know, you do a bunch of podcasts for a few months or maybe even a few weeks. And you're like, oh, the money's not coming in yet. And like, you just lose that motivation. Whereas if your true, you know, priority, or at least, you know, priority number two is that mission, that can kind of keep you going. Or if it's like you were saying, it starts out as therapy. If this is just your outlet to just release, and I just want to speak out into the world, and whatever comes, comes. Then again, like, that can keep you sustained. But back to the monetization piece, you know, if you want to make money, then there's other ways to do it. Are you lead generating back to another business? Are you using this as a way to essentially, you know, kind of showcase your voice and your writing skills, or, you know, whatever other kind of skills you have, to then maybe land a job at another company? So I think there's different ways to kind of go about it. But you first have to define what success means to you. And I can't necessarily tell you what that is, depending on your show.
Yeah, that sounds like some sage advice. Since you brought up about you brought up a couple of points that I wanted to hit on questions. So let me just go ahead and do that. Do you feel that Black podcasting is redefining how companies advertise within the Black community?
I don't know about redefining. I think we had I hate to call it this, but we had a moment. In, you know, from basically 2020 to 2022, where companies like, all right, you know, we have this Black initiative after George Floyd and all this press. And, you know, so there was a lot of spending, and that spending has dipped off. There's studies out there that shows, you know, that dip off, and also shows that some of these companies that made these commitments haven't fulfilled said commitments. So, you know, I very much feel a lot of it was kind of lip service. But I do say, you know, I do think that as there becomes more Black audiences to reach, I think that is going to increase our power here. You know, there are also studies that Black buying power, the digital buying power is strongest within the Black community. So like, part of what we try to do, you know, as we're trying to get money ourselves, is also to educate advertisers that they need to spend more money on Black podcasts, not just our own, because of that strong buying power. We should be able to charge higher premium rates to reach our Black audiences because of that buying power. So I think there's lots of opportunities there, but it's going to take a lot of education, not just from us, but other companies, to educate these advertisers as to our value. And just to get into kind of a, you know, industry term, like there's a CPM rate that a lot of us use to sell advertising on podcasts. And that means the cost per 1,000 downloads of a podcast. So for every 1,000 listeners or every 1,000 downloads we have, we can charge $25. Well, that's actually a nice number compared to YouTube and some other things, but our audiences are so strong with that buying power, we should be able to charge a higher premium rate than that. And so like, those are the things that we're trying to help change.
So you mentioned something in that answer, which gave me a question that I hadn't pre-thought. How do you feel about that drop-off, right? Because you know, I've talked to a couple of people that are in the DEI sector, and you know, and that's been their biggest complaint from corporations as far as how they're being laid off. But as somebody that deals with businesses through advertising, how do you feel about that lack of commitment, or that all of a sudden that, well, you use the term pod fade, so I'll play with it and say Black fade, right? Well, how do you feel about that?
It fucking pisses me off. It really does. It's like, to be completely 100 with it, like, I can't fucking stand it, because they just want a press release. And then like, the general public is like, oh, okay, cool. This company's doing great. They're doing great things in the community. They're helping. And no, they're not. Like, no, you did it because you want to look good, and you didn't want to actually help the community. You didn't want to actually invest in these shows. And so, yeah, it frustrates me a lot. And you know, that's why a Byron Allen is out there suing all these companies. Yes, he's also, again, a for-profit, you know, businessman, but he's also trying to help change things. And I appreciate that. And, you know, he's on the forefront for suing McDonald's and suing all these other companies who just want to give us lip service. So, yeah, man, I get very passionate about that one.
Yeah. And you brought up Byron Allen. He doesn't know me. I don't know him personally, but he is the Black Dick Clark, as far as I'm concerned. He's really the Byron Allen, because he's really doing something. When I heard that he was buying Black News Channel, I was so happy. I was urged. I said, please, man, buy it. Get it away from that dude with the Jaguars. Get it out of his hand.
Yep.
Let us have that one and do something with it. So I'm glad that he stepped up to the plate and did that. So the other question is, is there a fear that Black podcasting will become oversaturated?
I don't necessarily know if I call it a fear. I think that there is the definite possibility, and I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing, because, you know, again, like we started off this conversation talking about giving people an opportunity to have a voice. And so, you know, oversaturation just means that there's so many people who have something to say. Now, the problem comes in and like, how are these people able to market? How are they able to reach their audiences? And so I guess that's where the fear comes in is how are we going to cut through the noise? You know, someone like me who has a company and has multiple shows to be able to leverage, I have a little bit more of an opportunity than, say, you know, just an independent podcaster. So, you know, that's where we also try our best to amplify other shows. But yeah, I guess that is the concern is, as there are more shows coming in, how are you having people discover your podcast? And my advice to that at the moment would be to try to leverage YouTube as much as possible, leverage social media. But again, I think YouTube, because it is the biggest second search engine, and because we know our audiences are there, learn how to use the YouTube algorithm to your favor. YouTube Shorts right now are huge. That has helped us grow our virality. It's helped us grow our subscribers infinite, 10 times, you know, what we were doing before YouTube Shorts came along. So, you know, use some of these, you know, this content that you have, just short form content, to be able to get people to find your podcast. And then hopefully, you know, they stick around for the long run.
Yeah. You had talked about the monetization piece, and that's kind of where my mindset is about the oversaturation concern. Cause, you know, even though there's a lot of dollars out there, it's still an infinite number. And so, you know, I want to encourage people to do it, just like people encourage me to do it. But, you know, that's always kind of thing when people see a good thing, you know, everybody flocks and tries to do it. And, you know, maybe their heart's not in it like it should be, but, you know, they're just looking at the dollar signs. But that's always been a fear that it's like, well, everybody's doing a podcast now. You know what I'm saying? So it's like, what's the value in it? But I appreciate your answer, because everybody needs a voice. So let's close it out with this. What does the future of black podcasting look like to you?
I think the future of black podcasting to me looks like, and I think Black Podcast Association does a good job of this. I think, you know, there's other organizations that do a good job of, I think it's community supporting community. I think, you know, back in the day, we always hear the crabs in the barrel mentality. That doesn't really exist, especially in the podcasting space. I think we all uplift each other. And I think there's certain community groups that are helping uplift each other. And I think what we're realizing is that this is an on-demand platform. And even though there might be an oversaturation, we are able to increase the amount of listeners that are in the podcasting space, which then gives us all more opportunity to monetize and reach audiences. And so I think the future is us as Black people helping the podcast industry grow, which benefits us a lot. And so, yeah, whether it be, you know, strictly audio, whether it be in the video space of podcasting, I think there's lots of opportunities for Black podcasters. And I think also, as we've seen in other mediums, we tend to set trends. We tend to be, you know, a great creative flow for industries. And I think there's going to be a lot of, I don't want to say necessarily new formats, but new approaches to being able to create podcasts and the kind of subject matter we talk on and how we approach it that other, you know, other communities aren't bringing. And I think that there's going to be a really special community that we have within podcasting, similar to what we had with Black Twitter.
All right. Well, Brother Colbert, I'm going to let that be the last question, but go ahead and tell people, brag about the company a little bit, talk about your programming, how people can reach you, all that kind of stuff.
Sure. Yeah. So I have two companies, you know, the one we talk most about, you know, DCP Entertainment. You know, you can reach us at DCP Official on all social media platforms, with the exception of TikTok, which is at DCP_pods. And we're also, our website is www.dcpofficial.com. Then I also have Podstream Studios, where I'm actually recording right now. It's a space that we record a lot of our content out. If you've ever seen, you know, Torre's viral clips, that's where we're recording that show. Customizable backdrops. You know, we have a Times Square backdrop as well. And I say backdrop, but we're literally in the middle of Times Square. And this is a space that we do for ourselves, but also we run out to other content creators, podcasters. You can do live streaming. So that is podstreamstudios.com. And also you can find us on social media, Podstream Studios. So yeah, those are the two businesses where you can find us. And if you really do want to just follow me specifically, I'm only on Instagram at Chris Colbert Report.
All right. Well, Brother Colbert, it's an honor to meet you and talk to you. I appreciate what you're doing. I think it's always important to lift up Black people doing well, even though this is a political show. And I did get a political question in. I really think that the podcasting in general is going to have a major say so in how we can effectively get messages out and get the truth out to our constituents. So, again, I just want to thank you for coming on. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, guys. And we're going to catch y'all on the other side. All right, and we are back. So I hope that interview with Brother Colbert was enlightening to you. Like I said prior to the interview, this is a political show, and we tend to talk about political things more than anything else. But this is also a Black show. And like I explained, Black politics should lead to Black wealth, right? And, you know, in all facets. And so, you know, podcasting is a venue to improve our politics. And, you know, I got into all that before the introduction, but I just want to emphasize that. So it's really, really an honor to have somebody like Brother Colbert on to talk about the industry itself, what we are all doing as Black podcasters, in trying to put out a quality product and a quality message, right? So staying on this theme about politics equals wealth, right? Now we're going to get into another thing, which was very important. And you've heard me stress this over and over and over again. When Black politicians took power in the South, education was their main focus. That was a driving force, so much so that every one of their state constitutions made public education a right. And we know in the Black community that education equals wealth. So part of our politics in making sure that we increase Black wealth is that we have to focus on education. Y'all with me? All right. So that brings my next guest. Yes, I have another guest, y'all. See, I didn't tease it like that at the beginning. I just made it seem like I had one, but I got two. And so my second guest is a very, very distinguished gentleman who is working on a project that I believe is going to be a game changer in education, especially for African-American students. And so without further ado, let me go ahead and introduce him. His name is Dr. Mark Anthony Brown, and he is a retired Major General of the United States Air Force with 32 years of active duty experience. He was the Vice Commander of Air Education and Training Command, the division responsible for the annual education and training of nearly 300,000 airmen, and had many responsibilities in the funding mechanism within the USAF during his military service, including Chief Financial Officer for Air Force Material Command, which encompasses 38% of the United States Air Force's budget. All right. So I'll say that comment that you understand how this is the type of brother we need to highlight. Right. And then some of y'all probably had never heard of him before. I just did that part of the introduction. All right. Further, after retirement from the Air Force, Dr. Brown continued to serve his nation as chief operating officer for federal student aid at the U.S. Department of Education. In this role, Brown had statutory authority for all the nation's Title IV funding for 600,000 students and a total lending portfolio of $1.7 trillion and 6,000 partner institutions around the country. So Title IV is your Pell Grants, your work study, and your student loans. So this brother was over that. Okay. The lending portfolio of federal student aid is equivalent to that of the nation's five largest consumer lending banks. So you get an idea of what $1.7 trillion equates to. During his time at FSA, Brown oversaw the total digitization of financial services for students, parents, and borrowers. With over 20 digital improvements, FSA now provides the free application for federal student aid on all digital platforms, including mobile applications and artificial intelligence for routine student inquiries. All of us remember filling out that FAFSA when we were getting ready to go to college. In addition, faced with a pandemic, Brown oversaw the transformation of over 25 million borrowers from active to forbearance status, which temporarily eliminated payments for most students, parents, and borrowers across the country. Dr. Brown is now the executive director of the Student Freedom Initiative. The Student Freedom Initiative is a 501c3 nonprofit organization dedicated to ensuring freedom in professional and life choices for students attending minority-serving institutions. He is a graduate of National Defense University, where he received a Master's of National Security Strategy, Air Command and Staff College, where he received a Master's of Strategic Studies, Troy State University, where he received a Master's of Public Administration, Tuskegee University, where he got his BS in accounting, the Harvard School of Government, the Yale School of Management, and most recently, his doctorate of education from Baylor University. Ladies and gentlemen, it is my distinct honor and privilege to introduce, as a guest on this podcast, Dr. Mark Anthony Brown. All right, Dr. Mark Anthony Brown, how you doing, sir?
I'm doing great, Eric. How are you doing?
I'm doing lovely. To have you on the show is an honor. You're a Tuskegee man.
That's right. Tuskegee University. It was Tuskegee Institute when I started. But since 1881, it's been doing great things. And I'm just proud to be one small product of Tuskegee.
Yes, sir.
And all that is the country.
Yes, sir. I'm going to get back to that in a minute, but normally what I try to do with guests is if I can find a quote that's either related to their work or something they may have said or whatever, I try to throw that at them and get a response. So your quote is going to be real short. It says, student loans do not equal 40 acres and a mule. Tell me what that quote means to you.
Well, first, thanks, Eric, for picking that, because I think that's got to be one of my favorites. You know, way back in 1965, the first Higher Education Act, a guy named President Lyndon B. Johnson was trying to do something in the country that would lessen the income gap and the opportunity. People were returning from Vietnam. There was great racial divide in the country. And one of the things that he came up with was the Title IV, what we commonly know as the student loan program. So he was intended to give a hand up to students who wanted an education, desired one, but couldn't quite get there financially. It's a good concept. It's a very good concept. But what it may have missed is that if someone is starting education from a position of poverty, What they don't need is another loan, and their parents don't need a loan. That's not the concept of 40 acres and a mule, right? The concept of 40 acres and a mule was to overcome or to do something to help from historical disadvantages that people have been put in. The loan's the wrong instrument. The concept is right. So student loans, they don't equal 40 acres and a mule. And we've seen the results of student loans. So that's why I emphasize that they are not 40 acres and a mule. They're not going to lessen the gap. They may even worsen it in America. That's my viewpoint.
Right. And the main reason why I picked that was because as you were getting your doctoral degree from Baylor, that was the name of your thesis. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Yes, sir.
That's correct. That was the name of the thesis. I followed and studied 9 students at historically black colleges and universities and 9 presidents from historically black colleges and universities who were depending on financial aid and student loans to kind of navigate their higher education and how they were making those decisions. You know, one thing I would say, Eric, is the student loan portfolio in the country is $1.7 trillion. That's a lot of money, no matter how you look at it. And that number's gone down a little bit, but it's pretty roughly the same. One third of that is defaulted or delinquent. That one third is overrepresented by people of color. And what I learned during my dissertation was that we were using the wrong instrument that for these students. And that is if we wanted them to achieve the social and the economic mobility that's required from education.
So in my intro, I mentioned the fact that at one time you were the steward of that $1.7 trillion. So my question to you is, how did a guy who was a ROTC cadet at Tuskegee Institute, how did he end up being the guy that's over this initiative, the Student Freedom Initiative? How did you end up, how did that road get traveled?
Yeah, that's a great question. So you're right. I was an ROTC cadet at Tuskegee, and I went on to serve 32 years in the Air Force and retired the rank of Major General. And during that time, that, as you would imagine, involved lots of organizational responsibilities, leadership responsibilities, and operational responsibilities, including my last job, which was as the Deputy Commander for Air Education Training Command, which runs all of the schools, universities that are part of a very large Air Force. So there is a kinship, a relationship there between that and the decision of the Secretary of Education to appoint me as the Chief Operating Officer of the Office of Federal Student Aid at Department of Education. And that's exactly how it happened. When I retired, I got that appointment based on my experience running large organizations in the Air Force. And Federal Student Aid is a relatively large organization that services all of the country's financial aid and Title IV requirements. But I will tell you what I brought to that. That is of interest, I think, to now the Student Freedom Initiative. There's nothing like lived experience, right? You and I can talk about what we might do in a classroom. We can talk about the latest book we read, but nothing beats the lived experience. And when I was a freshman at Tuskegee, I had a roommate. That roommate was smart enough to be an engineer. He was in an engineering major. He was attending Tuskegee successfully in his first year. He did not have the finances to go back his second year and could not continue. It's not a unique story. You know, it's not a unique story. You look at the size of freshman classes, you look at the size of sophomore junior classes, and you see this waning down start to happen. Not always because they don't have the academic abilities, but because they don't have the finances. And so I kept that lived experience in my mind as I looked at this $1.7 trillion student portfolio that I had. And I heard some people talk about that one third of the folks that were delinquent and defaulted as folks who had not done something. But in the back of my head, I had the lived experience, right? I had the lived experience of good people being given the wrong instrument and led in the wrong way. And then I was fortunate enough that while I was there, our chairman, Robert F. Smith, was the graduation speaker at Morehouse College. And many of your viewers may have heard this, but, you know, at that graduation, I think it was class 2019, Robert said, I'm going to put some fuel in your bus. And he turned around and funded the student loans and financed the student loans for all of the students in the graduating class where it was applicable. That was about $38 million or so. And when he went to work that, I was over the Department of Education. Rob is very visionary. He's done a lot for our community. But one of his visions at that point in time was we need to do something in perpetuity, something that lasts more than just one top, like one scholarship, one student. That's not enough. We need something more systematic. That became the founding of the Student Freedom Initiative. I left the Department of Education, came here, and I'm the first executive director, first full-time executive director of the Student Freedom Initiative.
So talk about the initiative. What exactly, you talked about the kind of the origin of it, but get into the nuts and bolts. What does the initiative seek to do? What's its mission, and how it's going to go about fulfilling that mission?
Excellent. Excellent question. So wealth gap in America through the lens of education. There's a wealth gap in America, not news to anybody, but it's a stubborn one. If we were to talk, have this conversation 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago, we'd have been talking about the wealth gap in America. It would have been just as stubborn as it is today. It's been hard to overcome some systematic things in the country that ultimately relate in a wealth gap. So the purpose of the Student Freedom Initiative is to address that wealth gap, but to do so through the lens of education. So we do four things, and we're actively doing that as I sit here today. The first one is we offer an alternative to student loans, to specifically Parent PLUS loans for juniors and seniors majoring in STEM at now what is over 55, 56 historically Black colleges, universities, minority serving institutions, and one tribal college and university. And so what we say is if you're a junior, senior, you're majoring in STEM, you're making satisfactory academic progress, you've gone through your financial aid award package, you don't have to take a Parent PLUS loan. We will provide an income contingent agreement of up to $20,000 per academic year in your junior year, and the same thing in your senior year for valid cost. In other words, you don't have to go back to your parents, who obviously could not have written a check for college, or they would have been doing so, and we wouldn't have been in having this conversation, and then ask them to take out a loan. Although they don't have it, they can't really afford to pay it. And so we give an alternative to that for those students. But we don't stop there. It's important to say that this income contingent agreement, the student doesn't pay it back if they go to graduate school. They have the freedom to go to graduate school. If they decide to go into a public service, we spoke about my time in the Air Force. So if you're a lieutenant in the Air Force, for instance, or you're doing some other form of public service like first responders you don't have to pay it back during that period until you earn at least 230% or more of the poverty level. In other words, it's income contingent. Now, when you do pay it back, and this is important, I think, Eric, you don't pay it back to us. We're a nonprofit organization. We're not looking to collect it back in that way. You pay into what's called the Student Freedom Fund. That Freedom Fund is going to grow to $500 million as a basis and then be self-revolving, so it replenishes itself by the payments. That fund is there for all the colleges that are a part of this as an endowment for them without walls. So henceforth, in perpetuity, students can come to that fund, take the dollars out for an income contingent agreement, stay away from the debt trap of Parent PLUS loans. That's the beauty of this, is we're not giving out just a single scholarship. We're looking for this fund to keep students out of the debt trap that Parent PLUS loans and those things provide. And we have good evidence that says they do provide. That's the first thing to do. Second thing that we do is we work with our friends at InternXL to put people on an internship platform that has over 200 companies already a part of it, well over 20,000 students, where we look for at least two paid internships for students of all academic majors. The data says that two paid internships, or at least one paid internship, 67% of those students are going to work in that industry. So not just a final mile of education, but a good job to go with it, and the preparation to get that student for a good job. The third thing is we invest in the student themselves. I could go through a litany of programs and how we do that, but the one that sticks out is called the Handling Everyday Life Problems for Students. It is underwritten by Prudential, one of our industry partners, where we offer a $500 grant for a student in an emergency. Remember that those lived experiences, right? We know that students who come from fragile economic backgrounds, they run into things like a broken down car, the lamp on my computer didn't work, I had a death in the family, I need a round trip ticket home. We'll pay 75% of that emergency, the school will pay 25%, up to $1,000 per academic year per student. But our purpose is this: get over the emergency, get through it, and then persist to graduation. So the point is persistence to graduation. In another case, over just under 500 students have been provided $1,000 each in stock to manage that stock throughout the remaining part of their college career. They did that only after they completed two investment courses. What's our intent there? We kind of new muscles, right? We're trying to get this thought, to train this thought to say, this is what I could be doing, and introducing them to investment practices. A company called Stackwell and Prudential partnered with us on that. And then the fourth thing is we invest in the school itself. You know, ever since we had the land grant acts and we began the Morrill Act and we began our HBCUs, they have been pivotal to our communities. We all know them, right? We all know them as a central part of our communities. If you're in Tougaloo College, or if you're at Morehouse, or if you're at Alabama State or Florida A&M, you talk to those communities, right in the center is this economic impact and this kind of beacon of hope. It's the historically Black college and university. With meager resources, they've been able to do that. We invest in them. Cisco provided us $150 million gift, and that gift turned into an IT infrastructure upgrade for all of the schools that are part of our activity, and cybersecurity for them as well. So those are the four things that we do. They work together holistically. All of them are aimed at the same thing: the wealth gap in America through the lens of education.
Now, is Jackson State a part of that network? Because you had mentioned, sir, you mentioned Tougaloo. Is Jackson State part of the network too?
Jackson State is. That's right. Not just Jackson State, but Tougaloo, Mississippi Valley State. If we wanted to stay in Mississippi there for a while, we got quite a few HBCUs. So you know where they all were built, about the most of them, right? Right there in the South. Mm-hmm. And so most of them are our partner schools.
Yeah, I had to put it. That's my alma mater. So I had to throw that in while we were talking about Black colleges. But seriously, though, that is a very, very radical, interesting concept. One of the things that kind of got my mind going when you were talking about the stock, is there going to be any kind of financial literacy, entrepreneurship component as far as guiding these young people through in order to be responsible for those new muscles, right, that you're trying to create with them?
Right. You know, the important thing about or one of the important things about that particular activity is they couldn't get the $1,000 until they went through the paces of training and education. So there are two courses. They had to go through the two courses and complete them. And they're not able to liquidate this until graduation.
OK,
so yes, is the answer to your question. That was the start of it. There's also financial literacy in our program for first generation college students provided by one of our companies and first generation college parents. Think about this: first generation college parents and the these big financial decisions that involve financing higher ed. And when you start talking about capitalizing interest and you start talking about these kinds of things that go into financing a higher education, if you haven't experienced that yourself and people are just, you know, bringing it to you, you can make some serious mistakes. And so that is our focus. The financial literacy is part of our focus.
Yeah. And I liked about the parents, because both of my parents were first generation college parents. And I know that when it was time for me to make a decision where I was going to go to school, money was a big issue. How many scholarships? Growing up in Chicago, there was this Ada McKinley program. It's like if you weren't plugged into that, you weren't going to get any money for anything, not unless you got a scholarship directly from that school. So, you know, there were limited options for those parents. So I appreciate the fact that not only are you focusing in on the young people, but you're also focusing in on the grown folks that are now the role is reversed. They've got to make a decision about how they're going to pay or get their child into that college. So I think that's innovative and great forethought into that issue.
You know, Eric, when I was in the previous life as a chief operating officer of the Department of Education, I was arriving in Atlanta, Georgia, for a roundtable discussion with students there. We were talking about financial aid, those kind of things. My phone rings, and it's a parent. And she says, I have a parent plus loan on my credit report. And my son didn't, in this case, she said her son didn't finish school. She said, I'm making the payments on his behalf, but the debt to income ratio will prevent me from buying my first home. And so that big debt for the parent plus loan was there. She was making payments, but the debt to income ratio was going to keep her from buying a home. If you don't buy a home in this country, that is probably one of the biggest wealth growing steps that a family takes. So think about this. I'm going to go to college. I'm going to create social and economic mobility. It all works in the reverse. It ended up putting me further behind and not further ahead. That ought to speak to all of us on why the education for first generation college parents is as important as it is for first generation college students, if not more. That parent plus loan that we talked about, that's owned by 63% of HBCU students. They participate in a parent plus loan program sponsored by the federal government. The debt is held twice as long as others. And the default rate is five times as much. So if you look at those statistics, that's the reverse of what education is supposed to give us. That's what we're trying to get, be a part of. That's what we're trying to engage. That's what we're determined to turn around.
And it seems though that answers one of the questions I was going to ask, but I guess this one's more specific to a particular loan. Why should students and parents use the tool of SFI instead of Sallie Mae, for example?
Flexibility. So the federal government has just released a number of flexible terms, and this would be along the lines of Sallie Mae and other commercial providers, for a student loan that does not require parent signature, right? So they have extended income-driven repayments. They have some degree of forgiveness after a certain number of years. But that's for that first loan that's not subsidized by parents, right? Not signed, not uncollateralized is what technically we would call it, just the student signature based on need. So I set those aside for a second. There is this second one that if you still don't have enough money, you're able to get your parent's signature. We believe that's the one that does not get all the same flexibilities, does not give some of the forgiveness terms, that puts a student in a fixed payment process, or their parents in a fixed payment process that they may not be ready for. So we do things like we make sure that it's not fixed payment, it's income determined. We also wrap all those other things around the student that I was talking about. So we're going to bet on the student's future and not on his zip code of birth, right? So we're not asking his parents to sign this. We're saying you have great potential, and that's what we're going to invest in. But we don't stop there. What makes it better is the wraparound services. We're going to do things that keep you in school. We're going to do things that help you get employment. And we're going to make sure that when you pay money back, you feel something, because you're paying money back to who? Your school into its endowment without walls. If you had to make a payment back, Eric, and you could pay the large U.S. Treasury federal government, or you could pay back to that who gave you your start, think about that.
Oh, it's Jackson State all day. It's Jackson State all day long for me, and I'm sure it's Tuskegee for you. Yeah, yeah.
That's exactly right. And but imagine for our community that feeling. Imagine that feeling. I'll give you one other statistic that means I think this is different, and I think our product is unique. And I admit my bias, but I do think our product is unique. So we added up the endowments of 70% of our HBCUs. Just added them up. Just straight math. And we compared them to the endowment of one of the smallest Ivy League schools. That one endowment was a couple billion, about 2.1 billion. Those 70% of the HBCUs, it was still less, all of them together, less than that. So you and I are both, you're at Yale and I'm at Tuskegee, right? So we both are chemical engineers. We both have 4.0s. I get 4 years of Parent Plus loans. And you get an endowed scholarship to close the gap on that last mile of education costs you have for registration. You get out, we both go work for DuPont. We both make 120. We're doing real good. How much of my income is going to be servicing those loans for the next 10 to 20 years? How much of your income is going to be building wealth? When we get done, no matter how talented I may have been, the wealth gap may be the same or worse. That's what we're shooting after when we say systematic changes. That's what we're trying to change. We're trying to get in the middle of that decision process before it gets too far down the road and do something about it.
Yeah,
that's why.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
That's why I think we're unique. That's why I think our product is different than an off-the-shelf commercial loan or even a Parent PLUS loan provided by the federal government.
Yeah, I mean that scenario is the difference between me being able to go and get my first home and you living out of your car trying to get to work. You know, and that was a reality for a lot of kids in our generation. Coming out of college and especially getting into those technical positions, it was just, you know, the student debt plus, you know, the cost of housing or whatever, wherever you were situated, it was not working in our favor. So
yeah, but you gave the perfect scenario. When do you buy that first home, and what goes into your decision? If you buy that first home before you're 30, and I buy my first one when I'm 50. Remember that lady that called? She had already put her son through college and was trying to buy a first home. Others had bought it at, you know, 27.
Right.
So these are the things that are systematic. Like they're systematic. And I don't say it to fault anyone. But I do say it to say that you have to engineer a difference in that if you want it to happen. It's just not going to naturally change.
Right. And you brought up something about the endowments. That was the eye-opening thing for me when I was in the legislature, right? So in Mississippi, we have 8 state-supported schools. 3 of them are HBCUs. And what I noticed was that Ole Miss was only getting about 30% of their budget from the state, whereas Jackson State was getting 70%. And so the issue was, well, why is that discrepancy? And it was because of endowments. And that's why I think, you know, the piece where you talk about putting back into the schools, putting back into the endowments is very, very key. And I hope that part of that new muscle that you teach these young people is getting involved with their alumni, getting involved with putting money back into their schools. Just recently, I think last weekend, Sean Combs gave Jackson State $1 million. Well, that's great. And Jackson State needs that million for their endowment. But it'd been nice if somebody that graduated from Jackson State was able to write that $1 million check. And you feel me on that. So that's what I'm trying to get a mindset to, but that's a whole nother show, Doc. I just wanted to get that out on my chest.
I think it's a great point. But we gotta train that, right? You have to train that that investment. You know, one of the things that our chairman Robert Smith says that I really enjoy is he says we are the help that we need.
Right.
You know, in part that's it, right? We are the help that we need. Now everybody's not going to be P. Diddy, and not everybody's going to write $1 million, you know, and pass it around like that. Or Charles Barkley, who does the same. He went to Auburn, but he gave all the HBCUs in Alabama, I think, $1 million. Not, but you can do something. We can do something. And I think that's the muscle movement that we're hoping to grow.
Yes, sir. So will this organization offer these types of products to trade-based studies, meaning like, you know, plumbers and LPNs and electricians? Or is it just going to stay focused in on the STEM students?
We're at 3 community colleges so far that are offering trades. Denmark Tech is one of them as an example where they're offering some trade-based opportunities. The answer is yes. We haven't grown totally to that yet, but we're growing toward that. I'll give you an example. A student, a program that we are working on, cyber certifications are a way to increase one's job opportunities, right? Cybersecurity, those kind of things. That's a very good investment, we believe. right? Because that student, regardless of academic major, if they take a cyber certification with them, they're going to be on the upper end of the initial year of earnings when they come out of college. So that's a good investment. Our model is economic. It's, you know, why STEM majors? Because there are more STEM jobs than we'll be able to have STEM graduates at the current level. So we know that's a good investment. That's why the internships are so important, and our introductory to other kinds of things. So the answer to your question is yes, in the future, and it depends on the economics of that particular certification or specialization that the person is getting. We're working through some of that right now with a couple of them to be announced relatively soon.
And you're on a right track. I mean, the very premise of how student loans even started was because President Eisenhower felt that science and technology students needed more of them. And at that time in the United States, there weren't as many college graduates, white or black, as he felt they needed to be, and the nation felt they needed to be. So he came up with the student loan program, and they were targeting basically STEM students, and now it's expanded to everybody. So I'm just saying, for some people that may be critical, that's strategic, because if you can get those students, especially black students, in those majors, in those kind of jobs, that deals with that wealth gap that we're talking about. But speaking about the future, where do you see SFI in 20 years, and how do you get there?
Right. So that's a great question. I see us servicing at least 10,000 STEM graduates a year, at least 10,000 STEM graduates a year as an initial goal. And I see those STEM graduates paying back into this fund. And I see that same amount of students staying away from Parent PLUS debt. So that statistic I talked about in terms of an outcome, instead of having 63% of the students participating in Parent PLUS loans, how about only 50% of that 63%, right? And instead of having that debt last twice as long, how about cutting that down by 50%, right? In other words, we're fighting against this wealth gap. I see us servicing more tribal colleges and universities, as many HBCUs that we're servicing, and then other minority-serving institutions where students of colors are at, even though they may not be one of our 101 traditional HBCUs. So that's where I see us down the road, in the distant future, actually in the very near future. And I see this Endowment Without Walls being a source for those schools that they don't have today. And the industry involvement will be significant. I believe the industry involvement will be significant.
Well, considering who was the brainchild for it and considering how he made his money, I feel this would be what the investors would say, a good prospectus to look at and to see that fund would be sustainable for a long time. So where can people learn more about the organization and the work that you're doing? How accessible is the organization, and how can parents sign up to get their kids engaged in this fund?
So www.studentfreedominitiative.org will get you to our landing page. It'll get you to our site. When you get on there, you will see a list of schools. And if your student is a if you are a student of one of those partner schools, and there are over 50 of them, then you are already a part of the Student Freedom Initiative. And so there are a list of things that your student is eligible for, even if they're not a STEM major. And I talked about the handling everyday life problems for students and those kind of things. But if they are a STEM major and junior and senior, then your parents definitely should not be signing Parent PLUS loans for those students. We have a better option. We're glad to talk to you about that option. You can inquire with the school, or you can inquire directly with us on that site. Love to have a long conversation with you if you are in any way interested in any of those programs that you see there, or would just like more information.
Now, school has just started. Is it too late to have that conversation with you for this school year, or?
It is not.
Okay.
It's not, I'll give you an example. Students, some students got registered and they left a balance on that they would pay off during the course, or they would attempt to pay off during the course of the semester. That's not a new phenomenon either. That's been going on for some time. We'll get to registering for the spring, and some of those balances will be unpaid. And that student will have the choice of turning to a Parent PLUS loan or deciding how they're going to clear that balance. We want to help with that. If they are in those categories, we don't want them again to fall into that debt trap. So no, it's not too late. And before we know it, the students don't probably feel it go as fast, but before we know it, people will be registering for spring of 2024. So it's not too late.
All right. I wanted to get that out there so folks understand. Yeah, I know the school year started, but debt is going to be waiting on you. And if you've got an option to knock that down or eliminate it, I just wanted people to understand that. Look, Doc, it's been an honor to have you on. I appreciate the work that you're doing. I am glad that you had this forum to get this story out. And I wish you much success as well as Mr. Smith and others involved in this initiative to help young people out for generations to come.
Well, Eric, thank you for allowing this podcast and this platform for these important messages. And it's great to see one of my fellow HBCU grads, Jackson State, doing great things and communicating to the public. You're an example of what we mean when we say an investment in an HBCU has amazing outcomes. So thank you very much. And thanks to your audience for listening.
Thank you, sir. All right, guys, we're going to catch y'all on the other side. All right, and we are back. So, parents, I hope you got that last little nugget at the end of the interview. It is not too late. Students, it is not too late. Just because the school year has started doesn't mean that you can't get involved with the Student Freedom Initiative. That these folks have set you up to be successful. They've set themselves up to make sure that there are options, there is some financial flexibility so that when you get your degree, young folk, that you're not going to be straddled with debt. You parents, you won't be straddled with debt in trying to make sure that your child gets a quality education, right? So it's very, very important that y'all take advantage of that. Go ahead and inquire about it, if nothing else. But I've got a feeling, knowing the people that are involved with this, that it's going to be around for a long time, and it's going to help generations of African-American students and really start making a dent in the wealth gap in this nation. And again, that's what politics in the Black community is ultimately about. So again, we didn't get some congressman or some elected official or anything like that, you know, but we bring people on to talk about issues that in the political landscape, we're going to have to address. And sometimes it's good to talk to the people that are in the middle of the issue rather than somebody who is asked to weigh in on the issue, right? So just keep watching. Now, speaking about weighing in, I know some of y'all are expecting me to say something about the Jacksonville shooting. Well, I'm not. I'm not going to say anything on this podcast. Why? Because I've already said it on my mini moment, which if you subscribe to Patreon, that's patreon.com/A Moment with Eric Fleming Podcast, you'll get to hear my thoughts about what happened in Jacksonville. So that's why, again, like I said, this, because of the format that we've got now, you know, I'm trying not to keep y'all in class for 2 hours, you know, I'm trying. Yeah, I may have to, but for the most part, I'm trying to do better. So for issues like that, you know, that were timely, please subscribe to my Patreon. It's only $1, y'all. Please subscribe to the Portrait. If y'all want to be in a higher tier, lovely. I'll get you some down the road for doing that. But if you want to hear those kind of takes on something that was timely, something that is impactful, if we don't have time to talk about on a regular podcast show, please subscribe to that Patreon so you can hear my comments about that and offer some feedback. Let me know what you think about that. And, you know, the more people we get to subscribe, the more things we can do on this podcast. So, again, I want to thank my guests, Chris Colbert, who's the CEO of DCP Entertainment, and Dr. Mark Anthony Brown, the Executive Director for the Student Freedom Initiative. I appreciate them taking their time out of their busy schedules to talk to little old me. Hope that y'all enjoyed it. And until next time.